Hello, everybody.
That's a crowd.
Episode 22 of season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is Geek Speak. From beautiful Ben Lomond, California, I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room is Lindsay Lonnie. She's an engineering manager at Kintone and Hackbright mentor, and she was first on GeekSpeak in March of 2010.
Yeah, that was a while ago. I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for being here. Also, Brian Young, and Brian first came on GeekSpeak, as far as I can tell, in 2011, May, on the episode Getting Ready for Geek Dad Day. Hi, Brian Young.
Yeah, it was a Father's Day episode.
Your mic is unplugged. That's why it's not working. Literally unplugged. Is it plugged in?
Can I do this?
It's okay, yeah.
That is so geekly.
No, this is not MTV unplugged.
Well, hi, Brian Young.
Live show.
And we also have Miles Elam. Miles first came on the radio with me in 2002.
No.
2001?
No.
2000.
2000. September,
you know, it's funny.
2000.
Okay. September 2000. So Miles has been doing this with me for, I don't know, two episodes less than I have. And the first episode that we have on air of you is The State of Hard Drives with Seagate, and that's 2002. So I guess that our archive is offline.
Partially. Yes.
Got to get those DAT tapes out.
You're older than our archive.
You are older than our archive.
Older than dirt or older than DAT?
Well, he's a dad, so older than both. We also have Dr. Dawn Motika, and now she's a host and co-producer of Ask Dr. Dawn for years on KOSP. In fact, she predates GeekSpeak completely, and Dr. Dawn is a board-certified family practitioner of medicine in lots of accreditations galore. And one of the things to note of Dawn, and I mention this almost every time, we do this show, we've done this show for years, we did it live for years, and we all had laptops like this, and Dawn, quite regularly in her program, had nothing but a piece of paper in her mind. Dr. Dawn, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Oh, fun fact to go along with that.
Yeah.
We started following Dr. Dawn on Saturdays, January 7th, 2006.
Ooh, the archive is up to date. Nicely done. We are broadcasting this, recording this from Park Hall in Ben Lomond. And Park Hall is a lovely building that's owned by the trust of the Park Hall trustees. And we're in here today with a live audience. So you will hear a live audience for those listeners that are not in the room with me. Can the audience say hello? Let's get on with the show. I think we're going to start with Brian Young. Tell us, is the internet broken?
Well, a lot of people think so. So in our ongoing coverage of the fallout of both politics and social issues of the last year related to fake news, online abuse or trolling, and privacy discussions, there's been a lot of conversation on the show and others. In fact, I look back to the show last week with Brent Simmons and the whole discussion about the open web and how innovation in the free open web as opposed to maybe the commercial web that we see with Facebook and Twitter and so many other services kind of fits into this whole discussion as well. So we have had a lot of people trying to figure out what's going on with the web and why does it seem like the worst ideas are bubbling to the top. So Ed Williams was in a article in the New York Times several months ago, but I went back to reread it after that talk with Brent Simmons, and this is sort of a commercial view of the same problem, I think. So Ed Williams, who is known as the principal behind Blogger and then one of the founders of Twitter, is now the current CEO of Medium. And Medium, what you can notice about all of these things is that they are publishing platforms. Blogger, Twitter, Medium are all ways to get thoughts out without anybody in between. And this whole article traces through his thoughts about what's wrong with the web and what's broken. So it's interesting. The funny thing about the article is that Ed Williams is running Medium, which is not yet a successful company
You mean financially?
Financially successful company, allowing people to publish their thoughts on the web. But he set it up because looking at Twitter, looking at even maybe going back to Blogger, he didn't feel like the best thoughts were rising up to the top of the web.
I think Medium does that pretty well. I find a lot of interesting articles on Medium. Any of you writing on Medium?
I've been advised that I should start writing a blog on Medium because people use it so often.
Yeah,
for tracking blogs.
You posted once. On.
Yeah, I posted.
I kind of feel like Medium is long-form Twitter. If
really?
You have something quick to say, it's 140 characters, and then once you go past that, instead of doing the long, you know, series of tweets that you see with people, they go, just write a Medium post. Okay.
Well, he's been trying to make this a successful commercial venture, but there's a lot of critiques about it, and saying a lot of people saying that it never even would be a venture at all if it wasn't for the fact that he had lots of money to fund it himself. But the goal is exactly what we were talking about with Brent last week. The goal is to allow people to express their thoughts, to have the best thoughts rise to the top, to democratically allow these thoughts to get out into the world. And Medium is going through big changes, and they're trying to figure out how to monetize it. And he does not have the answer yet, but I thought it was interesting to see somebody in the commercial space trying to attack this same problem.
Cool. Thank you, Brian. Let's go to some medicine with Dr. Don. Tell us about the human genome and possibly changing it.
Well, we're going to start with this idea of epigenetics, which maybe people have heard of or haven't. But if we think about computer programming, it turns out our genomes actually program themselves continuously, both throughout our lives. And the interesting thing about this reprogramming is if a woman happens to be pregnant while something causes a reprogramming, let's suppose that she's exposed to a toxin that affects her epigenome, or she's starved, that would be a good one, so she doesn't get good nutrition. Her cells, the egg cells that form in her body that become her daughters, will
and
actually...
Her sons.
Sorry?
And her sons, but go on.
And her sons, but here's where it gets...
Oh, only her daughters.
Oh, but here's where it gets more interesting. Her granddaughters are also affected because the daughter's eggs are forming while she's in utero. So the concept is the genes actually will change across three generations that we can see.
Whoa.
So the mom's genes change, her daughter's genes are changed while she's still an embryo. She's an embryo, she's making her own eggs, and those eggs are changed as well.
What kind of change would happen if the woman was starving?
This is there are a couple of changes, but the most important one is called methylation, which is a CH3, carbon and three hydrogens. And this plops onto the DNA at the promoter sequence. So you can think of that as the start signal. And if you go and you put something on the start signal, it's like plugging the start signal, and that gene won't get made. Methylation can also be a start signal, but mostly what we're seeing in the case of these changes are you inhibit something from happening, and that changes the outcome for the next generation and the outcome of the next generation's next generation.
Whoa.
And we've done this in mice now, and we know that it takes, and this is so weird, 7 generations for it to go away. And there's an old American Indian adage about anything you do, you need to think about the 7 generations. And they actually nailed it.
Wow.
It's 7 generations to erase an epigenetic change.
So what
how Lamarckist?
Sorry?
How Lamarck-like?
Lamarck was right. That's the weird thing about this epigenetics. It, you know, changes that occur in your lifetime really are passed on to your offspring.
So let's say my...
Your DNA doesn't change, but what can be read on your DNA changes, which is...
Dawn, let's say that your mother was in starvation mode while your eggs were being formed, and then also when you were in utero. What would take place for you genetically? What differences might you have versus someone healthy like Lindsay? I don't know, I'm just pointing to somebody.
Well, let's start with the fact that I would be much more likely to be overweight because my body would want to hang on to all the calories it possibly could because it was instructed while I was an embryo the calories were deficient. Mm-hmm. So you can see how adaptive this would be in evolution.
Yeah. Have we seen other things of this nature rather than starvation, anything else that causes this?
Well, that was what I was going to talk about.
Please
so
do.
Now that we've set it up, let's talk about the concept of how your diet, or rather how your ancestors' diet, could affect you in other ways. So this article that I have on good old-fashioned paper with highlighting. I want you to see, because that's who I am. I'm a highlighter.
We call that
Highlighters dead, Anonymous.
We call that dead trees in the geek community.
Snarky. That was just plain
Sorry,
snarky.
Go on.
Okay, so vegetarian diets. If you've got multiple generations of vegetarian diets, one of the things that you don't get a lot of is fat. Now, we need fat for lots of things, storing energy and also making brains. So what we do is we make our own fat by taking those carbohydrates that we get from glucose and turning them into triglycerides or fatty acids.
My body's good at that.
Yes, many people have that skill. And the... But if you're a vegetarian, you are very, very good at making fatty acids from stuff like vegetables, which are not generally very high caloric. So what happens when you've got all this revved up making fatty acid epigenetics, because your genome is the same as the generations of meat eaters, but your epigenetics are different. So when you take that person and you plonk them into a modern commercial diet, what you get is you get a person who is maladapted to eating a lot of polyunsaturated vegetable oils, eating a lot of trans fat, eating a lot of meat. And so their risk, if they shift to that diet, their risk of heart disease, hypertension, is much higher. So not only do we have diabetes as an issue, but people are much more vulnerable to being sick from eating, let's say, a meat-ridden or a fat-ridden diet. And our modern diet with the industrial food chain, what we're getting is, you know, low fiber, some vegetables, you know, ketchup arguably, right, back to the Reagan era. But realistically, we don't get as many vegetables as we should anyway. And if your great-grandparents were primarily farmers eating a vegetable diet and occasionally meat, and you plonk down and start going to Starbucks and going to McDonald's and buying stuff from the vile and evil middle aisles of the supermarket where you should not stray, because there be dragons, you're much more likely to become inflamed and get sick.
Yeah.
So seven generations, though, you're talking a lag of 150 to 200 years.
That's 200 years of Twinkies and French fries before you're adapted?
Well, let's put it this way. If you grew up in, let's say, Asia, in the Asian subcontinent, and then you got a good college education, spoke English well, and decided to come and work in the Silicon Valley, we have a large population of people whose diet has shifted to a standard American diet in one generation. And particularly they and their children are highly vulnerable if they eat that diet to premature heart disease. And we're seeing that, by the way, in the people from Pakistan and people from India who are thin and they look healthy, but when you look at their arteries, they've got early CAD that's well in advance of what it should be, and it's turning out to be due to their epigenetic vulnerability.
Would this mean that your diet was really based on lineage and even just your mother and grandmother, you should scope your diet for what you were formed in? Does that make sense at this point, or do we know enough about it?
Actually, what makes sense at this point is to eat a lot at this point, because we aren't ready for personalized medicine to the point of me being able to tell you what you should eat based on your DNA any more than the blood type thing really works. What works is, I'm going to quote Michael Pollan, you know, eat food. Not food-like substances, mostly plants, and not too much.
All right. Thank you very much, Don. Well, let's talk about problems that America has. Miles, shall we?
Good segue.
And I'm not quite sure that this has to do with epigenetics.
But it might.
It might. Who knows? But there is proof from millions of Google searches that America is full of racist and selfish people.
Really?
Shocking.
Surprising.
It probably wouldn't surprise most of us that we type in searches to Google while we're by ourselves, that we wouldn't necessarily we wouldn't ask those same questions of people on the street.
I do spell checks all the time. So let's give us some examples. So this, I'm assuming, is a study based off of Google search history, anonymized to some degree, except that these are people in the United States.
Yes.
Okay. How bad is it?
Well, according to this, the Stevens Davidovich, the researchers, found that, quote, one in every 100 Google searches that included the word Obama also included KKK or the N-word. And these were searches that were not just confined to the South, but a fairly wide variety of areas, including upstate New York, western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio, rural Illinois, West Virginia, industrial Michigan. All places that Hillary Clinton lost.
Imagine that.
So do you know... Go ahead. Do you know for sure that these people are searching not because they don't know what those things are and they're curious? I'm being optimistic.
Yeah, in any study, they have to control for, you know...
Yes, you do. But at the same time, think about your own search habits. Think of how often you search for items as a one-off to see, this is something I'm curious about that I don't have any personal stake in. And how often you do searches, especially repeated searches, when you're looking for the same site over and over again, like in the case of what they found here, Stormfront, a white nationalist website.
So, I mean, where are the searches coming from there?
Searches coming
from... What do you mean, white nationalist site? What about the white nationalist site? How is it associated
with the
study?
So someone would type in, for example, Stormfront to find... Just like a lot of people will type in Facebook to Google.
Got it.
Take in the Facebook as opposed to typing in Facebook.com.
In fact, now that the location bar is a Google search, kind of inherently, if you don't really format a domain well, it does a search for you. So what you're saying is that they were associated with that site? The people that were searching for that were also searching for that site?
In general, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you knew their kind of their leanings.
Yeah, although, like, I mean, quick poll in the audience. How often have you searched for the word Stormfront, the name Stormfront? Yeah, not many in the audience here. Yeah. In fact, none. Thank you.
none that wanted to raise their hand.
I might have Googled Stormfront at some point in my past,
right.
And that was because I had read something about it and wanted to know, what is this site? Oh, I never want to go there again.
This might have been a typo for Stormtroopers. I mean, it could be.
Another optimist. I love it.
All right, well, is that it?
That's it.
All right, thank you.
Short and sweet.
I'm done talking about racism.
All right. Today. Lindsay, hi. Tell us what Amazon's doing.
Well, they just purchased Whole Foods for $13.7 billion.
Wow.
That's a lot of cabbage. Wah, wah. So people have been talking for a while about how Amazon's been putting some brick-and-mortar stores out of business because of
since its
cheap
creation? Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But now it's, you know, groceries because they have, like, Amazon Fresh and you can get your groceries delivered and things like that. Now they're buying some of the brick-and-mortar stores that they didn't put out of business, like Whole Foods, which is, you know, interesting. It's a click-and-collect strategy that they're doing, which is, like, you know, you order it and then you can go pick it up. They think that that's part of that process of buying those stores. And of course, at some point, we can speculate they might integrate shipping, which is their big thing. And we know they have some drone patents and things like that, and they were stopped originally by lawmakers working through privacy and protection issues with the cameras and, you know, flying things over people's houses and residential areas. But at this announcement, most big grocery retailers, the stock dropped, including even like Walmart and Kroger. But, of course, Amazon's rose. And they're saying, you know, that it could be kind of like a hostile takeover because the guy that started Whole Foods, he had this vision and had wanted to continue doing what he was doing. But there was a lot of stockholders that had bought up stock with a like-minded vision. And so the majority of stockholders were the ones that voted to sell to Amazon in the end for Whole Foods. And so if a business is driving, and stockholders are driving the grocery store stuff, is that best for the consumer? Probably not. Like, if I'm going to the store and someone's making a decision about the food that I'm buying, I don't necessarily want it to be the stockholders who are making that choice. And so some people are saying, should monopoly laws apply to this kind of thing? And should we be vigilant about contacting, you know, our public representatives and getting the monopoly laws updated to apply to things like this? But you know, it's just a matter of opinion. I mean, they're saying, like, if you're a Prime member, like an Amazon Prime member, and you go into a Whole Foods in the future, you know, this is just speculation, but let's say you have to use your Android phone to scan something, and you get a better price than somebody with an iPhone for your cabbage or whatever, and that, you know, if you're a Prime member, you get better prices than people who aren't and stuff like that. So who knows what will happen in the future.
Yeah.
But it's stuff to think about, and, you know, hopefully the laws will protect us in the end.
I am curious about the effect of Amazon having a whole bunch of local locations. Like right now, you can buy stuff and actually have it delivered to a pickup location. There's different pickup locations. But having every Whole Foods store potentially being a pickup, that's a pretty big draw. And it, of course, it might have just been, it might have been a mistake that they bought it. Can you put that up? You got to put it up on the screen.
You want me to put it up there.
You got
to
put it up on the screen. And I'll read it for... this is a tweet. Jeff Bezos saying, Alexa, buy me something from Whole Foods. Alexa, sure, Jeff, buying Whole Foods now. Oh, go ahead. We did cover the story. Like, the thing I'm excited about is the idea of going into a store and not having any money and just having cameras watch you and you pick up stuff and walk out and you purchase those things. As creepy as that sounds, it's kind of a neat idea.
Which is, of course, what their experiment is up in Seattle.
They have done it, yeah, and they could potentially retrofit every store. Don, you had something?
Well, I just want to put out a little cautionary note. I'm thinking about a country where people don't actually have access to certain products because they have a card in their pocket that says, well, we're only going to pay for these products and we're not going to pay for these. And we have these, you know, large corporations controlling what people can access in the way of life-saving substances. Mm-hmm. And
you're talking about prescription.
I'm talking about like a life-saving substance that maybe gets purchased by a corporation and then the price gets increased 1,000%. Now that couldn't happen
EpiPen.
Here. Of course, it couldn't happen with food.
Oh, interesting.
You
organic
know,
food.
I think we need to have some boundaries here about this, or we're going to end up the world where we have these corporations just having these vertical monopolies, not just within their own corporate place, but across. Just if you can sell it, Amazon can do it. I think that's a bad idea.
Hmm. That, on a side note with regard to economics. The amount that Amazon stock went up was equal or greater than the value of Whole Foods that they purchased for. So in a sense, they bought Whole Foods for free.
That's creepy.
They didn't lose money. Like, they spent the money, and then they got it right back.
Wow.
With that's the addition of a whole lot of brick-and-mortar stores.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that kind of business.
Don't cancel my Prime account yet.
Let's go ahead and talk about browser tech.
There's been a couple interesting things that have happened in recent weeks going on in browser tech and privacy and advertising. So the two of the major browser makers, Apple and Google, have been doing some really interesting moves. First of all, Google has announced that they are going to be adding to the Chrome browser a ad blocking system, which is really interesting considering that Alphabet and Google are based on ad revenues entirely. Nobody really expected this in the beginning, that they would be releasing some way to block ads through Chrome. A lot of people saying that would never happen, but it's really interesting when you start getting into the details. Basically what they're doing is there are standards that have been created by the Coalition for Better Ads, which I'm not sure how much that is Google.
Just to say, the ad industry right now is 97% controlled by Google and Facebook. Everyone else besides Google and Facebook is 3% of the ad industry.
Okay.
So just so good everyone content. Has
now,
that point
that
of reference.
Is that in volume or revenue?
Definitely in revenue, possibly in volume.
So what this is going to do is it's trying to tamp down on the things that are offending users most, the things that are alienating users and encouraging them to do ad blockers. What it's not going to do is to tame the tracking that happens inherently through ads. In fact, a lot of people are talking about how...
Wait, they're blocking ads but keeping tracking?
Essentially, the tracking will continue unabated, while the offensiveness of pop-up ads, which I don't
right,
see...
Right, but this makes perfect sense.
Yes, because they Google, want to encourage the ad ecosystem to thrive and not be blocked by people putting in ad blockers in
oh,
the browser.
Oh, that wasn't what I was thinking at all.
Oh,
I was
what's
thinking
that?
Google, when they first started, they were just a search company. Someone would go to them, and you would get ads, and then whoever happened to sign on to their ad market as they were trying to get bigger. Now Google is everywhere, not just for searches, but also for your mail, also for documents. They are literally everywhere. And so the ads are not necessarily the most lucrative spot, especially because people have learned to tune out the ads, just like you did with TV. And the commercial goes on, you get up and make a sandwich.
Then what's the lucrative part?
The lucrative part is knowing the browsing behavior, knowing where people are going, and then knowing what their habits might be.
But how do you make money off of them? If you know anything about
them. You make
them.
Money off the advertisers because you can give feedback.
So eventually it's an ad, but it's just a higher worth ad because it's more targeted.
If you can tell a marketer exactly who their demographic is going to be, how to play to that audience, and then target far fewer ads,
sure,
but to specific areas, it's going to be more lucrative. You can sell those ads for more.
And that's been the holy grail for advertising, is to target the ads specifically to the people that are ready to buy. I just heard something which I haven't been able to look into deeply, but I heard that Facebook is encouraging iBeacons being placed in stores, and that the reason why they separated messages from the main Facebook app was that they needed people to have notifications turned on, silent notifications, which you don't necessarily see as well, so that the technology can be hooked up so that they know that you've been in the store, and the silent push notification that goes on in the background of your phone will then be sent over there and communicate and say that you were in that store, and all of a sudden you will get ads for the store you were just in.
Oh, that's not creepy.
So, but that's exactly what they want to do, is they want to hook all these disparate sources of data together to determine who's interested in buying. And it's really building a surveillance architecture in order to be able to advertise. And Apple has gone a different tact. So WWDC was a couple weeks ago where they announced all of their new technologies, and Lyle was there.
I was.
And one of the things they announced is that Safari is going to have intelligent tracking prevention built in. I haven't dug deep into the technology. You didn't go to the session.
But I went to a Gruber recording after that, where two execs from Apple were there talking about how hard technically it was to stop tracking but not to block ads. And they're using machine learning to try to figure out that problem, which when I was sitting in the room, I wanted to raise my hand and go, "What? How are you doing that?" Because it's
exactly.
Actually extremely hard to do.
Well, essentially what they're doing is they're trying to find the patterns in which sites are showing up in these ads that are being pulled in. So the browser loads some page, and it starts loading scripts from different sites, and those scripts are running, and they have some sort of cookie, some sort of a tracking ID that they're sending back. Well, the little bit I understand is that they're looking at that traffic and trying to identify those IDs and change them so that no longer when you go to the site do you show up as 12345 on right. both sites. You'll get a random number in both sites.
Effectively, it's relatively common to have a kind of unique identifier associated with things. And if they're looking at lots of traffic, I can see that they could say, oh, this identifier is just for identification purposes. It's kind of a cool idea.
Now, this is something I want to show some folks.
Okay. Miles is going to show a visual thing that I will try to describe for the radio audience. He is opening a tab. He's doing full screen.
And I'm going to move this browser, which is...
This is when I start thinking about editing the podcast.
Pulling back on the mouse. He's touching the...
Yes, this is my preferred browser, Brave. But what I wanted to show was clicking on this icon. So just going to this one site, I have that many trackers, or things that go for
10 ad trackers, and you're at Ars Technica.
Yeah, and Ars Technica is actually a pretty good citizen.
So the wonderful thing about the web is there's this whole ecosystem, and there's two sides of it. There's, well, many sides, actually. There's the browser side, and then there's the server and the advertisers, the publishers. And nobody has full control over what you're looking at. You can change things that are being viewed in your web page. The advertisers can change what's being loaded up. So it's basically a war on two sides between being tracked and advertising and not being tracked and advertising.
You're now on CNET with 270 ad trackers. That's a lot. Go on, Brian.
And in this war, the two sides are constantly changing technology. The interesting thing that Apple's doing is this one-upmanship might be a little bit more difficult to fight this time since they're using something that's adaptive, something that's actually analyzing something about the page and something about what's being transferred to identify you. I'm sure it's not going to be the end of the story, but it's going to be a really interesting play in this field. So on one side, you've got Google, who is trying to change the ads so they're not as offensive, but continue allowing their advertisers to track. And on the other side, you've got Apple, who is trying to leave the ads completely unaffected, but stop the tracking. There's other people doing ad blocking, and this article that I'm pulling a lot of this summary from is from the EFF, which has their own technology, which they call Privacy Badger. It's a plugin, and they liken it to what Apple is trying to do without... They don't say that they're using machine learning to do this. The one other thing I wanted to mention about what Google is doing is this whole idea of blocking the ads is also going to come with the idea that, well, if you're going to block the ads, we're going to give you a way to pay and give money to the site that that you're blocking the ads from. And they've been doing this for a while, but they're trying to create an entire ecosystem here where it's more normal for somebody to say, well, I want to block these, and I will go ahead and give some small amount of money through their technology that's called a Google Contributor. Cool. So that's a nice idea. Hopefully people get paid for all their journalism and everything else that they produce, but it hasn't hit the mainstream yet.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KBCZ, Boulder Creek Community Radio. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm in the air room with me. With me right now is Don Motika, Lindsay Lonnie, Brian Young, and Miles Elam. And we're in Park Hall in Ben Lomond in a community event with an audience. And to prove that, I will say hello.
Let's talk about stress. I imagine that you have some experience with that.
I do, especially this week.
And when a person's under stress, they have what's called a fight-or-flight response. Their heart beats faster, blood goes away from their digestive system, very important, and heads for their muscles so they can run from the tiger, our classic metaphor. This is what we know about it, right? What you may not know about the fight-or-flight response is that it actually generates inflammatory molecules. So in other words, it's not just fight-or-flight from the tiger. Stress is pro-inflammatory.
What is the inflammatory aspect? What was it? What's it
well,
for?
So what it's for is a very good question. And it is what we're observing in modern wild-type humans, is that when they experience a stress response, you can measure increase in inflammatory mediators in their bloodstream. And it turns out this is due to NF-kappa-B, which is, remember I was talking about in epigenetics, how you put that methyl group on the promoter site? Mm-hmm. Well, NF-kappa-B is one of the little controller signals that goes and sits on the promoter site and turns on the production of inflammatory mediators, the ones that you block with ibuprofen, which is COX-1 and COX-2, those are made by NF-kappa-B. It turns on the DNA to make the COX-1 and COX-2, which then take fatty acids from your wall of your cell and turn it into inflammatory molecules. And you can block COX-1 and COX-2 by taking an ibuprofen or other anti-inflammatory medication.
Medication.
I misspoke, but then again, I didn't. I said anti-inflammatory meditation rather than anti-inflammatory medication. And it turns out that meditation actually turns down NF-kappa-B. So it goes upstream of the ibuprofen, and with repeat meditation, you actually change the cellular response. So instead of getting an inflammatory response with NF-kappa-B turning on inflammation, you get an anti-inflammatory response, and NF-kappa-B doesn't turn on.
Okay, wait a second.
You stop it from happening.
What's the definition of stress? What isn't is that inflammatory response system and organ shutting? I mean, you know, digestive tract being shut down. Is that a definition?
The definition of stress is that you have a chemical change in your bloodstream caused by your adrenal glands putting out this little thing called adrenaline or epinephrine. And with that change, a cascade of reactions occurs throughout your body, including your brain.
Does meditation reduce the amount of that goes into my bloodstream?
It reduces the duration, more importantly. So you still get the spike of epinephrine, but then you don't hold it. So it calms down much, much more quickly. So you can imagine if a person is regularly spending time in a relaxed state, that they actually change their internal settings, both at the level of the adrenal gland and at the level of the brain. And we can measure this as a shift in their cellular response.
Wow.
So the idea that stress maybe leads to heart disease, stress leads to diabetes is inflammatory, stress aggravates diabetes. And so these things play well together and amplify the problem, much like the positive feedback loops that you're talking about in the dynamic that you were just discussing.
Yeah. So does that mean now, Don, it seems like you're adding stress to my life. Now I need to meditate too, so I have to find time to meditate as well to make the stress go away?
You know, it doesn't take a lot of time.
How much time?
10 minutes a day. And if you spent the 10 minutes a day in a meditative state over the course, you'd get it back in improved efficiency.
Can you define meditative state?
Well, you have to be in alpha or theta, which is basically an EEG definition, but it's probably the most scientific definition. So we stick some electrodes on your head, and we look what your brain waves are doing. And when your brain waves are forming a sine wave at one of several periodicities, you are, by definition, in a meditative state.
So you're not going to get there by sitting on the couch, drinking a beer, watching your favorite show.
No.
I assume that.
No.
What about sitting on your back porch, watching the river go by?
Well, it would depend on what you were thinking about while you watched the river. The best thing to think about if you're trying to get there without, you know, chanting or something like that, is to be cultivating a sense of appreciation and gratitude. Science has shown that if you're there saying, "Isn't that a beautiful river? I am so lucky to be here. I feel so good about everyone around me. I feel so good about my house. I'm so grateful and thankful." And if you cultivate even a gratitude practice, which is still, you know, fairly cognitive in nature, you do start to shift the thresholds, and they can read it on a multi-track EEG. But your best way to do it is to stop talking.
Well, thank you, Don. I'm very grateful for your conversation.
Did she just end the show?
She did, almost. Miles, please go ahead.
You need the meditation to work this story off. There was a North Carolina law that was overturned by the Supreme Court recently that a person cannot be banned from social media. It violates their First Amendment protections. And some of us may go, First Amendment protection to be on Facebook? The reason why this was considered important was because that's where a lot of us have the social connections that can lead to, for example, renting an apartment or finding a job, other aspects like that.
Being connected to other human beings.
Being connected to other human beings. And that would also extend to banning sex offenders.
Banning sex offenders from what, social media?
Yeah, was overturned by the Supreme Court.
I see.
Now, this is all one that now our hackle's getting up. Wait a second, but that's someone I don't want to be on there. My daughter's on there.
Your daughter's not on there.
My daughter's not on there. She's too young. But but that said, it is something that, as a knee-jerk reaction, many of us say, okay, yes, we don't want them there. We don't want them with us.
Right, but if you take that to, do you want to allow them to write to an editor? Do you want to allow them to go to the street corner on top of a soapbox and speak their mind? Well, yeah. You definitely want to do that.
Right.
So all of a sudden you have to think broader about the social consequences of silencing people.
Right, but it also brings up the question of if, as a society, in terms of federal or state law, what is allowable or what is not allowed to be restricted, it does raise questions from a tech standpoint as to what is the responsibility for people who make social networks to enforce their own rules having to do with this. And then that brings up its whole other issues of exactly how intrusive do you want them to be into your personal life, because the same technology that can be used to identify a sex offender is the same one that identifies who you're having sex with, even if they are not violating, you know, any local laws.
We often draw this analogy between the online world and the real world. We also don't allow sex offenders to be within so many feet of a school or a, or other places where children are when it comes to pedophilia. Yeah. So, I mean, in the virtual world, you have to have some way to draw boundaries as well.
Currently, there is the COPPA, I believe is the acronym for the federal law that forbids sites from hosting people under the age of 13 without a parent's consent, and then having the parent's consent ends up being such an extra pain in the butt that many sites just say, you're not allowed to be on here unless you're 13 years or older.
Now, reference Facebook, for example. That's
policy. Which is not to say that there aren't people who are younger than 13 who their parents don't know about, because the catches for that are...
What year were you born?
Yeah, how do you sign on to Facebook? Oh, here's
an
email address
and
here's... Yeah. So it's not perfect, but it's still something that we're not quite ready for as a society. It's something we need to iron these kinks out.
Do you agree with this ruling, this court ruling?
I do, but then again, I'm also the...
So you like sex offenders, is what you're saying.
Thank you. I do follow that line of thought, which is if you forbid this one class of, you know, free speech or whatever right might have you, then the next administration or the next cycle comes around and it will be used against you.
Right.
So be very careful which ones you restrict.
That point taken, but just because one avenue of speech is removed doesn't mean that you don't have free speech, does it?
This is where I was talking about, it wasn't just about being on social media and sharing cat videos. We're also talking about platforms that you have to be able to get employment, that you have to be able to do all these other things. And there's also that aspect of what happens when the 18-year-old is dating their 17-year-old partner and then get picked up, you know, and signed up as a sex offender.
Did you guys follow the story, the analysis of the president currently is blocking people on Twitter? And so when you're logged in with Twitter, even though most things are posted publicly, when you're logged in, the system can actually stop you from reading other people's posts. Of course, you can log out and then read them, but you can't submit back to the person. And so the president's account has been banning people that doesn't want to speak with.
Which not the POTUS account, but the real Donald Trump account.
The real Donald Trump account.
So, let me be clear on this. So when you're blocked, if you're logged in, you can't see their posts?
You can't see their posts.
Okay.
And you can't obviously comment on their posts. And then you can log out to see them, of course, or you can make another account. So it's like it's not a very strong blocking, but at some representation, it's a block. But the thing is, the president's not allowed in a public forum to decide what members of society can listen to them or not, and which members can participate. There's laws around that. So the using of Twitter as a public platform for communication and then the selective blocking people is actually a First Amendment problem. And it's kind
of this back and forth of someone has said, well, it's the personal account, the real Donald Trump, rather than the official POTUS account.
Right.
And so therefore he can block anyone he wants, except for the fact that Sean Spicer has come out saying the statements that he makes on Twitter are official statements from the president.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So
Let's stop talking about that.
And this is a lawsuit. It isn't an action by Congress. It's actually private citizens who have been blocked who have said this is unacceptable.
Let's talk about something more fun. Girl Scouts, Lindsay?
Yeah, so let's teach our, you know, approach that from another angle and also educate our children on how to protect themselves online. So the Girl Scouts partnered with Palo Alto Networks to release 18 new cybersecurity badges for members to earn over the next 2 years. And they teach young children about cyberbullying and how to protect themselves online, and older children learning about white hat hacking and creating firewalls and good stuff like that.
Whoa, okay. Get a little closer to your mic when you get a chance. But okay. So you're saying is that...
I thought you were telling me to speed up.
No, I didn't mean to speed you up. I'm so sorry. Slow down. Explain again. So what you're saying is that the Girl Scouts are actually able to get trained at this point in cybersecurity and earn a badge?
Yes, exactly. So Palo Alto Networks, there's 18 badges that they can get over the next 2 years. So, you know, it would take you 2 years to fill your sash. Yeah. I was a Girl Scout, so I know how that works. And there's things like coding skills. You know, they can learn scripting if they're older. White hat hacking, which we've had conversations about in the past. And, you know, creating firewalls, which is fun, Linux skills. And the younger ones will learn how to protect themselves online, how to avoid cyberbullying, and how to deal with it if it happens, and things like data privacy, not to put their names online, things
those
like that, their ages,
skills.
Their geographic location. Yeah. So a lot of great stuff to educate children on how to protect themselves.
Cool.
They're helping to encourage youth in STEM, which I think is great, and hashtag change the ratio. Go girls.
Nice.
Go girls.
So now is a time in our program where I decide whether we're going to talk about the story that has the company in that I work for in the title. So, Brian, tell me about Netflix.
Or otherwise known as, this is the time I make Lyle shut up. Okay, so so we're going to cover a story about Netflix, and there's a few interesting angles to this, and it actually is about metadata. The data that is about the data that's being broadcast. And we can kind of see some metadata live here to see what Lyle does talk about and what he doesn't talk about. And what's interesting about that is metadata can leak a lot of information. In this case, we have been in a world where since Edward Snowden's NSA information was dumped on the public, we have been much more cautious about security and privacy, and there's been a large movement to encrypt most of the traffic, if not all the traffic, on the web. And yes, that deserves a clap as well. So in this effort to do this, Netflix has also attempted to put all of their movies and everything you watch over a SSL TLS connection so that anybody snooping can't see what kind of movies you're watching.
I implemented that for images for Netflix because for a while Netflix images were actually in HTTP, and in the last year or so we switched over and I did some of that work.
He just can't help himself.
What's interesting is along with all this, there's a lot of researchers out there trying to figure out what is working, what's not, and one set of researchers has released a paper, which is a couple months old, maybe outdated news, but what they looked into is, can you determine what people are watching even though the movies that are going across there are encrypted? And what they found out is that because of the way metadata is handled in the stream of information that's encrypted, and because of the way that movies are broken up into chunks and there is this variable bitrate procedure that happens so that if you're on a good connection, you get a really high-quality encoding of the movie. If you're on a bad connection, you get low quality, and many steps in between there. And the way these things are broadcast over the Internet, there is information that's being leaked. These researchers were able to search through Netflix's database and watch through their system some 40-some thousand movies on Netflix and break it up into unique little chunks of 184 million chunks and put that in a database. And they are able to then look at anybody's traffic on Netflix and figure out with a 99.7% accuracy, I may have that a little bit off, what you're watching. So all of a sudden, the efforts that...
Even though it's all HTTPS.
Even though it's all HTTPS. Wow. It's a completely encrypted SSL TLS connection. Yeah. But the way the metadata is put into the packets, the way the packets are predictably fingerprintable because of their size of each different bit rate, right. They are able to track back what they're seeing to the movie that they fingerprinted.
Cool.
Right. To break it down... If you've seen the movie Imitation Game, how are they able to break the code? Because someone was sending the exact same message multiple times. And so if you find the same message multiple times, if you know what the message is going to be ahead of time, then you can find the key much more easily. And this is what's happening here, is because those movies are the same content over and over and over again, you're able to make a comparison analysis.
It's a harder problem. There's a finite number of possibilities that they can look for, and all of a sudden they can use these techniques to fingerprint. Now, encryption is made to use random noise so that you can't just easily do this. But it's the pattern of how these this metadata is packed in there that is creating something that is leaking the information.
I wouldn't be surprised if we work on this problem.
You wouldn't be surprised at all. They did offer some suggestions that sound like they're fairly minor changes that would allow this to be masked in the future. So this is possibly even fixed today.
Hey, Brian, I got to ask you something. If everybody in this room, everybody listening, knew what you were watching on Netflix, would you be upset?
Well, that's the thing. Okay, so the reason why I like this story is it seems inconsequential, doesn't it? But, you know, if somebody saw exactly what my TV watching was, I'm not afraid of that. But I'm sure there are people out there that don't want to be seen. And the reason why it's important is we now live in a world where, because of the way the net neutrality laws have been pulled back, and because of the commercial interests, you've got ISPs that don't want to simply be a dumb pipe that you pay right. for traffic. They want to get as much value out of the customers as possible. They're finding new business models in order to charge or not charge you for things, to find ways of monetizing your traffic in other ways.
Verizon, I mean, like an ISP would be the company that could potentially do that, right, and find out which members of their, which subscribers of theirs are watching action movies versus horror movies or something, and then be able to market them effectively.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a problem. It's definitely a problem that needs to be fixed. I hope Netflix fixes it.
And as long as this kind of information is being collected, you get into a situation where information about you is out there. Is it going to be sold to a broker to right. connect your interests to what Facebook knows about you? And this is the kind of surveillance system for advertising that's being set up. But it can be repurposed by governments or databases of this information can be leaked. There was a database that the RNC had that was just announced that it was sitting open on Amazon services for the past, I think, 14 days, which has all of what the RNC knew about 200 million American voters and what their...
200 million registered. They don't actually vote.
That says what their initial... what they initially think their proclivity would be, who they'd vote for, what kind of issues they would feel strongly about. And as soon as the data is collected, somebody out there is trying to get it. Did I interrupt you?
Well, I just want to comment that the potentials with the big data for profiling and... thought manipulation are huge, and I come from a generation where I grew up reading 1984 and Brave New World. And if the technologies that currently are being evolved existed, let's say, during the Third Reich, we'd all be speaking German. So it worries me to be handing on a silver platter a society that's simply not ready, and I do not trust not to point the gun in the wrong direction. So I think we need to really, really push privacy as a key core value going forward. And if we don't, we'll suffer the consequences. It's very evident where things would head otherwise, left to themselves.
Thank you both. May I move on?
Yes.
Miles, you want to... Is it really your turn? All right. Go ahead. Tell us about other employees making mistakes for their companies.
Yeah, think about the worst thing you ever did on a job, especially on your first day.
Really?
Yeah, you're fired.
That wasn't it.
You know, it's funny, Miles, I'm going to tell a little story because it was so long I didn't talk. The first job
Wait,
I ever...
Wait, hold on. You stopped talking? I didn't notice.
The first job I ever had that I got paid money, not like a babysitting gig or something, but like employed by an employer... was a janitorial job. I lasted one day, and it was for the building we're currently sitting in. I was a janitor, and I also had a girlfriend, my first girlfriend, and I really wanted to go do something with her, and so I didn't clean, and it was bad. I got fired. And now I sit on the same trust. Ha ha. But go on. That was my first and only time I got fired.
Right. Imagine you're a junior developer. You're just starting your job, literally your first day, and you accidentally delete the production database.
Whoops.
The
Where did this happen?
Well, I'm not going to share that specific name there, but it was a copy and paste error. You know, we've all done copy and paste before, but
it RM-R.
Was a little bit more, yeah. And so a production database, so it was probably like Drop, Cascade, or something like that.
Right.
So what was this running? Was this a website? Is this a the fundamental database?
But that's, I think, that's going to discuss the actual
I think it's
job.
I think not, it's governmental.
Yeah.
Data no, safer on Amazon.
I will say that it was a private company, but at the same time, the response to it is something that leads something to be desired. The developer was fired. You know, no one's really surprised by that, but that is a shame because that exposed something that we should all learn and take to heart, which is if someone can just walk in off the street as a new hire and take down your company is not organized correctly.
You're doing something wrong.
Maybe the junior developer shouldn't have been fired. Maybe the CTO should have been fired.
That's the idea.
The other thing is, like, of all the employees on the planet, who's the person most least likely to destroy your database? That person right there. They will never do that again.
Yeah, exactly. That's that whole point of when you hire someone on, it's not just for that person the expertise that they have ahead of time. It's also paying for the time it takes for that person to get up to speed, to learn what the ins and outs of the system and whatnot. You've now hired someone that, as you said, has learned a very important lesson and will likely never do that again. In fact, I doubt anyone at the company will do that again. Then again, you remove the company's production database with no viable backups.
What? They didn't have viable backups?
I don't believe they did.
So
that
you're
was
saying
something
a,
that I'd
a formal
definitely
private company.
Definitely the CTO.
So my pilot
like
friend would
not
say,
a company anymore.
My pilot friend would say, no plane just crashes because of one mistake.
Yeah.
There are layers and layers and layers of fault before you get there.
Or rather, not necessarily that they had no backups, but they didn't have an up-to-the-minute backup.
Right. Well, that's not uncommon. I mean, having a real-time backup is actually a little challenging technically.
When I say up-to-the-minute, I mean
days.
Nothing that day.
Miles, can you tell us what company it is or what?
No, I'm not. Because that's not the point.
So I actually have I did this when I was just starting out in my computer graphics career. It wasn't quite to the level of destroying everything, but the studio I was working in where you wanted to render your TV commercial or your movie effects, it had a huge render farm. And at this time, they had just gotten to the point where they didn't have people working 24 hours and swapping out of having three people in one computer throughout that 24-hour period. So the resources had gotten to the point where they weren't entirely like gold, but they were close. And the way you would render out your shots or your movie is you'd put this script out on the server, and it would distribute it and render each frame as an individual script. Well, I put at the top of this script one little mistake, which would spawn every other script I intended to run every time each one of these run. Within about 20 minutes, the entire studio was wondering what was going on, and nothing worked for another few hours.
And that was you?
That was me.
Was this Pixar? Or
no, this was Rhythm and Hues.
Rhythm and Hues, okay.
Fun story. This wasn't at a job, but this was a scraper that I made to grab news headlines off of Slashdot. Years ago.
Yeah.
So the script was a nice Perl script that would query every minute and then check to see, have I hit this particular series of sites more, you know, in the last half hour? If I haven't, then hit it again. I think I put an extra semicolon where I shouldn't have. And it started hitting the site, the same URL, over and over again every minute over the entire weekend. Mm-hmm. Their analytics caught me, and I woke up that Monday morning to seeing a bright pink screen saying I was banned. What? I didn't do anything. Oh, I did.
In just a minute, Lindsay's going to give a little bit of a shout-out to someone who's passed away recently. But first, I want to let you know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence's user permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geeks said hi. I want to thank Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song, and also Greg Merkley, our Canadian correspondent, who titled today's episode, Broken Genome Tracks Girl Scouts, semicolon, live! 2 exclamation points. I also want to thank Don Motika and Brian Young and Miles Elam for joining me on stage today. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
And also the amazing audience. Yes, thank you so much. And I also want to thank Lindsay Lani, who's going to close the show with a bit of a tribute.
Yep. I just wanted to thank Chuck Thacker, who was a member of the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and invented one of the inventors of the Alto computer, released in 1973, had resizable windows, graphical user interface, a mouse, and Ethernet. And it didn't become famous, but later we started using Ethernet, and we still use it today. So thanks for inventing that. It has been really useful.
And letting Apple steal it.
You can learn more about our show and every program of our episodes since 2002 up at geekspeak.org. And, of course, you can be a contributor if you'd like to just go to geekspeak.org/support. Thank you so much for listening to episode 22 of season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'll see you next week. All right, and we're up. Okay, so we
need to post it. One last thing.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. It's fantastic to have a time to see everybody and not just hear of you. So welcome to here. It was crazy to do this. One of our listeners came, hi, and said he's coming to Santa Cruz for a trip. What to do in Santa Cruz? I said, oh, well, go down to Henry Cowell and enjoy the railroads and come and do a live show with us. So that's why we did this. So thank you for coming up here. And we haven't done a live show in... I don't know if we've ever done one. Have we ever done one?
Wait a second.
Yeah, we have.
Are you quiet, Brian?
The back of the pickup truck.
Yeah, we've done it
in the rainy parade.
Oh, the parade shows. Yeah,
wait,
of course.
Lyle, yeah. Our first 10 years were nothing but live shows.
Well, I meant live in person. I didn't live that way. So it was kind of a crazy thing to do, and I needed help, and I got some help from some wonderful people. Ben and his entire family, the Ackers, helped out by getting posters around town. Thank you very much. Where are you, Ben? Right back there. Thank you. And we also, I decided on the Event Llama site to go ahead and suggest that people could buy some, give us some money at the same to actually pay for all the food and drinks. And we had three people participate. Two, I'll use the first name because I didn't ask them first. Daniel and Terry both contributed. Thank you very much. And we also had an amazing donation, quite a large amount, that actually paid for everybody to have drinks tonight. So that's from Chris Irwin of Irwin Systems, and he's been a patron of ours for quite a while. One of the people that actually joins us on air, well, listens to us live on air weekly because he contributes so much every week. And Chris just, I said, well, with this kind of donation, what would you like me to say? And he said, tell them that we help people get rid of Lotus Notes problems. And he learned a lot from the show, and he's been listening for a long time. And he says, buy everyone a beer on me, and I hope this is an annual event. So thank you very much, Chris. We are also being streamed live on the internets. Ooh, exciting. By David back there in the back. Thank you, David, from Ecoplex Media. And that is allowing everybody to hear us live, including Greg Merkley, who's listening in with a title, I'm sure, forthcoming. I also want to thank two Park Hall trustee members who are on the board with me of this wonderful hall. This hall has been in the ownership of Ben Lomond community, everyone within a mile, or is it a mile and a half? Mile and a half, as the crow flies from this building, owns this building, and it's kept in a trust by eight awesome people and me. Denise Gorham back there running the concessions. Thank you, Denise. And Steve Edmonds in the back of the house running the sound and helping set up. Thank you, Steve. I'll also introduce these people in just a second, but first we'll start the radio show. But before I do that, I want to say one thank you to Maggie Hoogs.
Maggie.
Thank you very much for putting up with me. We are in the middle of moving. The kids are getting out of school. I'm going on a work trip. And we're doing a live event for GeekSpeak. And the reason why that's even possible at all is because Maggie supports me so much. So thank you very much, Maggie. Oh, and Randy just turned on lights for us. So thank you, Randy. That's awesome. And I was recording. That's good. All right, so we are going to do... We could keep doing stories, but I think we'll do a Q&A. So does anyone have a question? Oh my gosh, we do have questions. Okay, let's start in the back. Mardine.
Okay, so I have an iPhone, and my iPhone tells me all the time that I don't have enough iCloud space to back it up. And I've tried to find out what I need to do to get enough iCloud space to back it up, and it is so difficult to figure that out. Is this important? Should I have iCloud space to back up my iPhone?
Awesome question. Anybody else have this problem? Okay, one, two. All right, so what's happening is first off, yes, you should absolutely have a backup of your iPhone, because when it's lost, you'll lose your photos, and those are important, and maybe audio recordings. What you could do, of course, is pay Apple, and it's a monthly fee. I think I pay for it. I think it's $5 a month, something like that. It gives us a little bit more. Apple's notoriously expensive on their costs for backup. Like everything Apple does, it costs more money than it should. But I think it's probably worth it from a simplicity's sake. Alternatively, you can do your own backup on your computer. So using iTunes, you can actually back up your device, and you just should do that really regularly so that when you do drop it in the toilet, you can get your data back. right? Anything else?
Yeah, I personally back up to my laptop, and then I back up to a time capsule. But then again, I already have that equipment, and compared to the cost of doing that, like getting a laptop and getting a time capsule, if all you have is your phone, it makes sense to put the money in for an iCloud account.
And, you know, I'm going to make one more suggestion. When I said the photos, that is actually the important thing on your phone, because, like, your email you'd probably be able to get again, and pretty much everything else on your phone came from somewhere else. But the thing that your phone actually created, unless you're a big typist on your phone, is your photos and videos. So I would recommend, if you don't want to spend money to make sure those things are safe, go ahead and use Google. And if you download the Google app, Google Photos, it'll upload all of your photos and videos to Google and actually do some really cool recognition stuff on it, so you can, like, find all pictures of dogs that you have. It means that Google has access to your photo library, obviously, and it's not the full resolution quality, but at least you won't lose your photos if you drop your toilet.
Yeah, that's something about iCloud, though, is that actually is encrypted, and you are the only one who has access to it.
Right. Like the story earlier about Apple being kind of awesome about privacy, they encrypt it on your device and upload it, so they can't get to your files, but you can get them back.
With one minor note, which is if you get into any of the particularly private things on your iPhone, like using it for health, I can't remember what other areas are, but currently, if you're using the health app and putting health data in there from your Fitbit or your Apple Watch, that does not get backed up through iCloud. That only is backed up if you connect it to your computer.
That's right. And you have to, when you back up to your computer, you have to have it encrypted on your computer, or they will erase it.
It's simple.
See, salt problem solved. Ben,
it's awesome.
Hey, thanks, y'all. This has been rad. Can we set out some, like, tape squares and do a sumo bots competition in here?
Yeah, we could do that in this room.
Sweet!
We rent this facility all the time, and it's available for community events. And, yeah, parkhall.benloman.org is the address. And, yeah, we totally do it. You didn't mean it right now, right?
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, this question is actually for Miles, but I wanted to show Don I wrote it down on a piece of paper. do you think with a person's digital life being fully trackable, i.e. track when a couple gets pregnant, they give birth, they track the photos of the kids' birthdays every year and stuff, that an age field is going to be able to become a little bit more accurate in the future?
That's a tough one, just because with regard to age, the younger a person is, the less of a digital footprint they have to be able to predict upon. So theoretically, I guess.
Miles, does Google know you have a child?
Google does know I have a child.
And does Google, well, of course you work for Google while you have a child, so that's cheating. But I mean, the internet.
That aspect. Also assumes a real name policy, too. So, you know, she uses, you know, Whippoorwill Fenderson, then who knows if they'd be able to catch her. It's funny that you mentioned whether we'd know whether someone was pregnant or not, because that was actually a story we covered about 10 years ago, where, was it Amazon had?
No, it was like a grocery store. Target.
Oh, Target
or CVS.
Had, yeah, given a coupon for maternal, for early childhood
specifically,
stuff.
Specifically, a father was really angry that this thing had come in saying pregnancy, blah, blah, blah. And then he didn't know that his daughter was pregnant, but the store did from the medicine she was buying.
10 years ago.
Yeah. So now they know all the time.
But that's kind of an interesting question because we grew up in a time when, you know, Google didn't know that we were born. But now let's say you put your daughter's name somewhere online with a, you know, birth announcement. And then, you know, 18 years from now, she signs up for a Facebook account. Is it going to know she's 18, you know, somehow be able to track the name or some sort of, oh, this person lives in this area, it still lives in this area, and is now 18 years old. Is it that same person that was born 18 years ago? It's an interesting concept.
Yeah, if there's an incentive to know that, then, or a commercial incentive, then the commercial companies will do that.
Hey, you want to start a company?
Well, when I was 18, I received a Gillette razor in the mail because at the time, the name Lindsay was a male name. It wasn't until like 10 years later that it became a popular girl's name. So you never know. I don't know how they knew that I was born or that I had just turned 18. And that was, you know, I won't say how long ago, but it was a while ago. So there's ways.
This is a two-part. I want to thank Dr. Don. She's been on the phone many times with my wife. And about my mother, which extended her life period for a long time. You guys had numerous conversations, and thank you.
You beat us, Don. Basically, you've saved family members' lives.
Yes.
We just talked about tech.
Yeah, we saved you from your iCloud account.
the other question I have for any one of you is, with technology the way it is and the internet the way it is, you see the big box stores charging you fees, and I'm noticing now that some of these other places that actually offer something to you are starting to charge membership fees and things like that. Do you see like Amazon and Google, even all your search engines, things like that, actually beginning to charge for these things and having memberships?
That's what Prime is, isn't it?
Well, Amazon Prime, yeah, definitely a membership kind of thing.
Prime. Prime.
But yeah, Amazon does that with Amazon Prime, which also gives you music and all these other things. Of course, having a monthly revenue from any customer is a lot better than having every once in a while revenue. Do you think Google might do it?
YouTube Red?
Yeah.
Well, we've
YouTube Red is Google's,
you know,
video
why not?
Service.
I would totally pay to be protected from trackers and from intrusive ads.
Yeah.
And you know, if that's what's funding the services I'm getting, then can I fund them instead?
So you're saying you'd welcome that?
Depends on what I get to avoid, but yeah, a moderate fee for Google searches without the other stuff, and particularly without the tracking, yeah.
This is a very contentious point right now in technology history, in that you have a lot of news organizations that are now putting up paywalls. If you have an ad blocker, they'll say like, hey, you got an ad blocker up, you need to buy a subscription if you want to watch this, or turn off your ad blocker. Then there's browsers like the one I showed earlier, Brave, that showed how many trackers it was blocking. That isn't just an ad blocker, it's also a potential revenue stream, in that you can pay by Bitcoin, like attached to an account and put in Bitcoin, so that you say, all right, my experience is worth, you know, $15 a month to be unencumbered. And it will track within the browser, not out to a third party, but it will track within the browser where you go to, divvy up how much time you spent on each of them, and give that $15 as a proportional amount to those, and then the site just identifies themselves, goes to there, and reclaims the money. And those two models, the one of the subscription to the specific site and the Brave ad block but pay money to there, are at odds. They're incompatible with one another, and we're working through that.
Yeah. All right, any other questions? Yes.
Do any of you have a VPN? And
So do any of us have a VPN, and do we think it's a waste of time if we don't have it? So I don't pay for a VPN service personally. I do have a VPN so I can access data from at my home from outside my home. I don't pay for it because you still have to place your trust somewhere. So if I pay for a VPN is a virtual private network. So you can find a company somewhere in the world and you can pay them money, and then all your traffic can be encrypted at your home and sent to them, and then unencrypted, and then your access point is through them. And the benefit of that is I personally hate Comcast, but I pay them all the time. And so I could potentially hide all my traffic. Comcast wouldn't know anything about me, and I could just trust this other entity. But you have to pick that other entity, and there's a bit of a bandwidth cost to it. So now the question is, actually sometimes in your favor, depending, but the question is, do you trust them more than the Comcast ISP? I think I could see a future where I would definitely pay a lot to some company I trusted because I didn't trust my ISP. Miles, you want to take this one?
Our security consultant, Alex, who's been on the show a few times, he definitely has a VPN that he uses on a regular basis. If you want to get the programming from Netflix that's only available in Canada, you can get a VPN. if you do it carefully. The thing with VPNs that I would recommend, though, is do not go with a free one. Free is much the same thing as everything else that's online. If you're not paying for it, it means that you're the product. And so, you know, Facebook is free because they're selling your eyeballs to advertisers.
And so advertisers are the customer and you're the product.
And so free VPNs work the same way. So if you are going to get a VPN...
Pay for it.
Pay for it.
Brian?
On the flip side, just because you are paying for it doesn't mean they aren't also tracking you and selling you.
That's right.
No, if you pay for a VPN, you want to know what their policy is, especially their logging policy. It depends what your purpose for the VPN is. So like Lyle, I have a VPN running at my home, so I can be somewhere else in a coffee shop and hide my traffic from them. But I'm not trying to hide my traffic from anybody else because Comcast knows what I'm doing.
Does Alex pay for a VPN service, or is he just...
Yeah, he pays for it.
Okay, so he does have some company that he likes. All right, we'll make a recommendation on next week's show on what VPN service to get, if you plan to get one. Lindsay?
Yeah, I also have a paid VPN service because I got really paranoid after all of the, you know, released and leaked information and realizing how much of my information was, you know, part of the government. A lot of people say, oh, well, if I'm not doing anything wrong, it doesn't matter what people can see. But just as a matter of my own personal ethics, I don't adhere to that. So my answer would be, like, it depends on how paranoid you are, really, like how much you're willing to pay. You know, if you're willing to pay $5 a month and you're not that paranoid, or if you're willing to pay $20 a month and you're super paranoid, just do your research.
what if you're extremely paranoid, but you've just given up because you know it's futile?
Then I can't help you. I'm sorry. Okay.
More meditation, probably. Don,
meditation.
Do you... any other questions?
I have a question.
Michael?
What is the current accuracy of commercially available GPS, and where do you think it will be in the next 20 years as it applies specifically to... land boundary surveys. There's going to be a point where you're going to be able to identify exactly where you are in the world, and there's going to be some major discrepancies. We have a property where there's plus or minus 70 feet.
Well,
that's a larger parcel, but I'm just really curious about that.
Yeah, I just went through purchasing land, and the tricky part of it is that the land ownership idea, first off, might be immoral, but let's leave that aside. What you're buying when you're buying land is you're buying this idea that there's a bit of space there that's yours, and the definition of that space is these trust documents that have been passed down, these legal documents that have been... So you're really buying a legal definition of land. You're not buying land, you're buying the legal acceptance of that land. And then you're insured by a deed of trust company to make sure that they'll fight for you when someone says it's actually 70 feet this direction. So it's not a technical problem, it's a social legal problem, really. Right now, we all have in our pockets, I don't know if everybody does, but a lot of us do, have devices that can get accuracy down to, well, given time, down to like an inch. I mean, it's really...
Well,
so we. Okay, go ahead.
So just to pipe in here from our Canadian correspondent, Greg, he's saying that it's about 10 yards, but there are techniques, he says, to get down to a centimeter.
Yep. Yeah. The GPS system, when it was first created, it's a U.S. military system, a satellite system that goes around the planet. There's a whole bunch of satellites, and you're triangulating your location based off those satellites. So you can find height and also XY on the planet. And they didn't want those to be really... They want it to be only the military to use them perfectly so that they could, like, hit a missile into this building and have us people have, like, 10 meters of separation. So the government was sending out this data early on, GPS, and they would just deviate that location by some random amount over periods of time. And commercial industry was like, you know, actually, we know where, like, this radio signal is. And if we put a GPS system there and then they tell us it's actually somewhere else, we can subtract the difference because we know where the physical antenna is, and then we could just broadcast that information on radio using radio digital, RDS, radio digital signal. It's like a pager system, the same system pagers were used for. And they compensated for that, getting GPS back down again to like 3 feet, which is really about the device's antenna integrity. So pretty much right away, it was high granularity, good enough for military use. And so there was like, it kind of was given up, and now the accuracy is just right, always, all the time. And then our devices are, it is true that they're not perfect, they're like more like a 3 meters kind of thing, but when you collect data over a period of time and you also have a gyroscope in it and you're moving around, over time the device has enough CPUs to actually figure out exactly where you are. So the long and short of it is the land thing is actually a legal problem, not a technical problem. Yes? More information about this?
Yeah.
Okay, come on, Mike. Instant feedback.
I'm Glenn Nelson.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
Nice to meet you.
Hi, Miles. Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hey, Glenn.
There are semi-professional GPS units which only cost a few hundred dollars, and they can use what's called differential GPS. And you'd have two of them, and I did this 10 years ago, so I don't remember precisely. But anyway, you'd have two of them or more, and you could get extremely accurate down to the inch differential between the two GPS units, and then you can reference them back to a known fixed base station. We were down in Monterey, and the base station was Pigeon Point, and we were getting accuracies to within, you know, an inch or two, and you don't have to wait around. You don't have to average. It's just instantaneous.
That's amazing.
And I think most of the GPS devices that are in our pockets could do that if you could just break out the pinouts on it and get that signal.
Yeah, cool. Does that help, Michael?
It sounds like there's going to be some lawyers making some money in the future.
The one sure thing about technology always changes, but lawyers
always
make money.
Prediction.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll wrap up the Q&A. One more question? Okay, one more question.
Kind of back to that content and commercial thing. I'm thinking like, more and more, the ads are getting blocked and these memberships, so you don't have to look at the ads and such. And how much do you think we're going to see a shift to product placement in the actual content?
I think we already have, but yeah, I think that the ads we're seeing right now are so integrated to sites that it is like product placement at some level. Anybody else?
Because I just keep seeing that go away.
Yeah.
Well, there's those YouTube people that the FTC sued because they were not saying they were sponsored or product placement, and the things they were talking about are Instagram people.
Right. So what you're saying is they were slipping in ads without informing that it was an ad.
I just wanted to make one quick comment, a positive comment on the Amazon and Whole Foods thing. When you're cooking and you discover you're out of an onion... Their drone will just bring you an onion. You don't have to get in the car and go over to the...
True. Bedroom. And you can just tell your Echo to do it for you.
As I say, just tell Amazon for you automatically. You'll just have onions appear.
Then again, it assumes that Whole Foods is closer than your local grocery store.
Or your yard.
And you'll never know your neighbor if you don't go borrow an onion from them.
So, speaking of neighbors, I just really appreciate you guys came out and got to meet each other. Please hang out for a while, have some more wine, beer, meet us. Make sure to say hi to us and introduce yourselves and such. It's really great to touch base with our audience. And I wanted to... Tina... Oh, she's still here. The station manager of KVCZ is in the back there. Say hi, Tina. we went back on air a while ago, and we're broadcast in Boulder Creek. and a little bit of Ben Lomond. In fact, you can get the signal here. But we are working right now to raise enough funds to put the antenna 1,000 feet up higher on a mountain, which means we'd get to Felton, which is really exciting for me because I want the entire San Lorenzo Valley to be listening to radio. When KOSP died a couple years ago, a year and a half ago, whatever, it was very sad, of course, because I was very involved. I was involved in the station for a long time. And one of the things that was very challenging to the station, it wasn't geographically bound. It had a very large area, a community, which was the Central Coast of California. Who lives in the Central Coast of California? A lot of us, right? But do you say to people, oh, I'm from the Central Coast of California? No, you say you're like, I'm in Santa Cruz or I'm in Scotts Valley. You're like, you kind of mention a city. And so I thought that one of the things that KOSP didn't have was this geographic bound, like, community around it. And because it got big. When it started, it was just Santa Cruz proper, pretty much, in Monterey. But KBCZ, even when it gets bigger, it's going to be the San Lorenzo Valley, which is basically the home I think of. When people say, where are you from? I say Santa Cruz Mountains. And then if they go, oh, Ben Lomond? I go, oh, actually, no, I'm in Brookdale. So I just feel like it's really a benefit to our community to have a central voice, like a newspaper, a radio station. It really ties us together. So I want to just make a big shout-out and thanks to Tina for making the station happen. Thank you very much. And I urge you to donate some money to the station because we are in a drive to get some money. So if you feel like having a community radio station or a community facility like this available to you and you'd like to drop some money, please feel free to do so. There is a jar back there for the food, but any of the proceeds that are extra after the food goes to those two organizations. So writing a check for $100 and dropping in there, that's great. I don't want to do the money transfer, so it'd be KBCZ for a check. What's that? KBCZ.org. You can donate up there, which is awesome. And for the hall, it would be Park Hall Community Trust, a check if you wanted to do that. Thank you all very much. Stay around and chat with us.